Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The new Congress has been in session for almost 5 weeks now, and not that anybody's counting, but they haven't really done what they said they'd do. We're not talking about minimum wage or new ethics rules. It's that power of the purse thing. House Democrats started laying the groundwork today for a fight over Iraq. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers to bring about ideas for nourishing the world.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. TGIF, everybody. It's the 9th of February. Great to have you with us. The president wants another $100 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan. That much we knew last week. We also knew he wasn't going to get it without the executive branch spending some quality time with Congress. Top Army officers made the trek up to Capitol Hill today to answer questions from one of the administration's most powerful critics. Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the story.
Congressman John Murtha is working on language that would only fund the buildup in Iraq if the troops met readiness standards on training and equipment. That means the Pennsylvania Democrat could very well block the Iraq troop buildup, given equipment shortages and the precious little training time the military's been facing. During today's hearing of a defense subcommittee that Murtha chairs, he pressed Army Chief of Staff General Peter Schumacher on whether the 21,000 extra troops planned for Iraq are ready.
I mean, I'm sure you'd like to send 21,000 tomorrow, but wouldn't you agree we can't send 21,000 tomorrow, General?
Well, sir, we're surging, and we're doing it on the schedule that was asked for. It is a challenge to do it, no question about it.
This is Murtha's way of taking a stand. Even if he doesn't stop the buildup, he says at least the forces would be ready. But Daniel Gurray of the Lexington Institute says the Pentagon could shift money around to pay for the additional troops without Congress's blessing.
One of the ways you could treat it would be by reducing the presence of support units in Iraq, take the money you saved and put it towards combat brigades.
But that would lead to a showdown with Congress. Dennis McDonough of the Center for American Progress says the Pentagon really doesn't want to bite the hand that feeds it.
Congress is going to be enacting funding requirements for this war for years to come.
The Secretary of Defense is scheduled to appear before Murtha's subcommittee later this month. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Congressman Murtha's committee wasn't the only one that was busy today. The House Tax Writing Committee released a $1.2 billion package of tax cuts for small businesses. The House is trying to find some common ground with the Senate on an increase to the minimum wage. But whatever common ground there is proving shaky. Steve Tripoli at the Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk has more.
The Senate wants $8 billion in small business tax cuts. House Ways and Means Chief Charlie Rangel had a tart response to that plan. He told reporters, "When you start with $8 billion, my hearing aid is off." That doesn't mean the House proposal is a shot across the Senate's or even the Republicans' bow. In fact, ranking Ways and Means Republican Jim McCrary unveiled the House package with Rangel, and he defends Rangel's take on the Senate plan.
He thought there was too much in there, and some of the tax breaks in the Senate package did not go to small businesses. So we tailored our package to target those small businesses who are going to be most affected by the minimum wage increase.
Still, the House plan acknowledges certain realities, the main one being that the minimum wage hike may not fly without some tax breaks. The dueling plans will likely end up in a House-Senate conference. McCrary has a prediction about the outcome.
The final number will probably be somewhere between the House and the Senate.
No surprise there, or at any rate not as big a surprise as this apparent outbreak of congressional bipartisanship. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Carl Icahn's got a new project. You know the name, of course. Icahn's picture is probably in the dictionary right next to the entry for corporate raider. He's got a private equity fund that he runs. It's made a deal to buy the auto parts maker Lear for close to $3 billion. That's a lot of money in any case, but as car makers have been struggling to keep up, their parts suppliers haven't had the easiest time either. Five of this country's biggest auto parts companies have filed for bankruptcy in the past couple of years. Marketplace's Amy Scott has more now on what Icahn might have in mind for Lear.
Private equity loves struggling companies with potential.
They're cheap to buy but promise future profits. That makes the auto parts industry a prime target these days. Companies have been battered by losses at Detroit's Big Three, but global demand for their products is growing. Analyst John Novak with Morningstar says Lear's in better shape than most. It controls about 40% of the U.S. market for auto seats.
They've been going through a significant restructuring in order to reduce costs and diversify their customer base. So that's underway and should start to produce some results. So there's a number of reasons why Lear would be attractive to an investor like Carl Icahn.
And possibly other investors. Lear has 45 days to entertain other offers. It would have to pay Icahn's fund a breakup fee if it backed out. At least one major investor is holding out for a better price. Icahn's paying $36 a share. In a letter to Lear's board, one hedge fund manager said the company's worth closer to $60 a share. Analyst Jim Gillette with CSM Worldwide says that may be a bit optimistic.
The thing that I'm concerned about is how long it's going to take to actually have some of these changes come to fruition and create greater profits.
Lear may do it faster as a privately held company. Gillette says the cloud hanging over the U.S. auto industry has made it hard for suppliers to raise money in the public market. Though Icahn's known for shaking things up, signs are he plans to keep Lear pretty much intact. The deal leaves the current management in place. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
From car parts to airplanes and their parts we go. India's biggest air show wraps up this weekend. More than 50 American defense and aerospace companies made their way to Aero India this year. They brought all their flashiest fighters and helicopters, and I bet they put on a heck of a show. But largely, the trip was a long way to go for not much of a payoff. Miranda Kennedy reports now from New Delhi.
India said it will spend $30 billion upgrading its military over the next 5 years. But the biggest announcement at this year's air show was a disappointment for U.S. defense companies. The Indian Air Force will buy 40 fighter jets from Russia, its biggest arms supplier since the days of the Cold War. Former Defense Secretary William Cohen brought a U.S. delegation here this week.
We look at it with some confidence in the future that Russia's not simply coming in and grabbing up all the contracts, because that's the way they've always done it. They've got a lot of old Russian equipment, and that's going to have to be replaced. They're looking to replace it with the best quality they can find. We think the United States will do very well.
That's the expectation of the U.S. defense industry after it lobbied congressional lawmakers to recognize India as a nuclear power. Now it wants something in return in the form of lucrative military contracts. But India's made it clear that it has other allies to consider, like Russia, Israel, and China. The head of Boeing India, Anil Shrikande, says he's willing to sharpen his elbows.
We know there's competition out there, and we don't take competition lightly, but the whole environment in terms of Indo-U.S. relationships, it's on an upward trajectory, as you know, and if we can come together on that, I see no reason why we can't come together on the sale of military platforms.
Later this year, Boeing and Lockheed will bid against dozens of international companies for an order of 126 fighter jets for the Indian Air Force. That deal is worth as much as $9 billion. In New Delhi, I'm Miranda Kennedy for Marketplace.
Investors broke out of the funk they've been in all week. They just couldn't make those arrows point up, though. We'll have the details and we'll look at the week on Wall Street when we do the numbers. South Korean agriculture officials don't really care where the beef is, so long as it's not coming from the United States. What was once the third largest overseas market for American cattle has sharply limited imports since mad cow disease was discovered here just over 3 years ago. Trade negotiators meeting in Washington this week haven't been able to come to an agreement on when those shipments might begin again. But domestically, beef is still a big business, tens of billions of dollars. And there's a food fight brewing over the origins of the humble hamburger. Brian Bull reports.
So cheese and onion?
No onion.
So just a cheeseburger?
Just cheeseburger, yeah.
It's late afternoon at Louie's Lunch in New Haven, Connecticut. Fourth-generation proprietor Jeff Lassen is cooking beef patties on a vertical cast-iron broiler that's been in use for more than a century.
We started our business in 1895, and we stand by our claim that we did the first burger in 1900. And it's up to everybody else to prove their claims and, you know, last as long as we have.
Legend says founder Louis Lassen made history when he stuck a slab of chopped beef between two slices of toast for a customer on the run. That account has been repeated on shows like Oprah and Good Morning America. The Library of Congress also calls Louis' lunch the birthplace of the burger. But more than 1,600 miles to the west, Texas Representative Betty Brown of Athens has filed a resolution challenging that claim. It says that the first hamburger was made by Athens resident Fletch Davis at his lunch stand in the 1880s. Athens resident and booster Peggy Gould says Davis later visited the 1904 World's Fair in St. Louis.
And set up a stand on the Midway and started cooking his sandwich. The rest is history.
Gould is the town's reigning burger queen and helps organize the annual cook-off that celebrates Davis's invention. The event pulls in some $10,000 for local businesses. They take a lot of pride in those claims, but more than 1,200 miles to the north in Wisconsin.
There's no need to search. There's no need to roam. Just come to Seymour. It's the hamburger's home.
That's Bill Collar performing the role of local mascot Hamburger Charlie. Collar says the town of Seymour, Wisconsin, has proof that early food proprietor Charlie Negrin created the Great American Burger at a county fair in 1885.
He was actually selling meatballs and people weren't buying those, so he packed a meatball in between two pieces of bread and squashed it together and called it a hamburger.
A local lawmaker is even crafting a resolution to refute Texas's claim on the burger and names Seymour as its rightful cradle. Collar says that in an internet vote during the National Burger Festival in Akron, Ohio last year, Seymour beat out the claims of rivals like Athens and New Haven.
Well, not to mix the metaphors, but that's a lot of baloney.
John Mariani is author of the Encyclopedia of American Food and Drink. He says the terms hamburger and hamburger steak predate all known claims by decades. He says unlike Toll House cookies and Eggs Benedict, the hamburger's precise point of origin is lost in the mists of culinary time. Still, Mariani appreciates why the various claims stir up such supersized competition.
It's an icon of American food culture, so to claim that you were the first ones to have invented it is quite a claim indeed and has a lot of marketing possibilities around it.
Seymour librarian and community organizer Elizabeth Timmons agrees. The town's annual Burger Fest draws in 20,000 visitors and generates up to $15,000 for local scholarships and improvement efforts. She says the national burger battle benefits everyone.
The more the merrier. I mean, if we can all have fun with it and compete with each other and all help our communities by having this claim, I think it's great.
In Seymour, Wisconsin, I'm Brian Bull for Marketplace.
It's time to check the week on Wall Street with stockbroker and business analyst David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas.
I thought you would never get here.
Well, what? You can't tell me you've been overworked this week.
No, I just want to get out of here. You know, it's just an incredibly boring week. Plus, you know the other thing? I just figured this out.
What's that?
So you remember, so we talked last week, but we were just back from
wherever
vacation.
We were, yeah.
Oh, well, that's right. And then the week before, I was in Austria and you were... wherever you are.
Out gallivanting around. I don't know.
There you go. But anyway, the long and short of it is, this is the first five-day week I've worked since, I don't know, maybe before Thanksgiving.
I'd love
and
to
it
feel
was
bad
just,
for
it
you.
Was the longest week. There wasn't a whole lot of economic news. The market just didn't do a thing. Most days we traded below 1.5 billion shares. It was just incredibly boring.
Well, V. Gates, as they say, what gives?
Well, the best thing I could think of is that it's a rest. Is we had that big run up in the fourth quarter and it was just gangbusters. Then you remember we started off real slow in January. Then it kind of picked up a little while. And then I think it's tired. I think it's resting. Now, I mean, there are some legitimate concerns out there. I don't think the market's sophisticated enough to factor these in
now. That's reassuring.
I think it's just acting from gut instinct. But
well, I mean, it's been going for a long, long time. I did read this week that there's some record it just set or is on the verge of setting a record.
Well, no. There were a lot of the records. The Dow Industrials Average traded at above 12,700 for the first time ever. It didn't close there. The Transportation Average hit a new all-time high. I think some of the broader-based averages did. It was very, very impressive. But it's earnings season, and the earnings have been really good. We've had 75% of the S&P 500 report. Hmm. But something is about to happen. It looks like earnings overall for the fourth quarter are going to be up, the first call people tell me, 10.9%.
Okay.
Okay? That'll be the 14th consecutive quarter of double-digit earnings gains.
I know where you're going.
Yeah.
I know
where
you're going.
Do you?
Yeah.
Because the first quarter projection when we began this new year was 8.7.
Yeah.
Now they're saying earnings are probably going to be up 4.6%.
Ooh.
And for the full year, only up about 7%. So, I mean, there's a slower, it's not, you know, I don't know that you call it a slowdown, but a slower rate of growth.
7% is still a really nice number, though. It's tough to feel bad for corporate America growing at
7%. 7% is absolutely dandy, and I don't have any problems with it, but, you know, it is a certain adjustment. So maybe that's what we're seeing here. We've got oil that traded today successfully above $60 a barrel for the first time, I think, all year. And then just if you didn't think this week was a little squirrely, we end with General Motors showing a gain of $2.21 today. The biggest gainer of the big-time blue chips was GM.
Go figure that one out. A topic for another day. David Johnson down in Dallas, Texas. Thank you, David.
Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Coming up, arguing the finer points of Jewish law.
Cynical people who come in say, gee, that's great. The Almighty said keep Shabbat, and you guys are finding ways around it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 56 points today, nearly 0.5% to finish at 12,580. Hence, we get the wah-wah trombones. For the week, the Dow wound up 0.5% poorer. The NASDAQ trimmed 28 points, 1.1% to end at 2459. For the week, the NASDAQ down 0.2%. The S&P 500 gave up 10 points or 0.7%, closing at 1438. For the week, the S&P 500 slipped 0.7%. A collapse in prices for memory chips rippled through the tech world today. Intel lost 1.5%. Micron, the largest U.S. maker of memory chips, lost 2.75%. Apple bit off 3.33%. Microsoft and IBM each lost about 1% or so. MasterCard swung to a fourth quarter profit, but the credit card company still debited nearly 10% off its stock on a lukewarm forecast. Car makers accelerated on the possibility of falling costs, and a Deutsche Bank upgrade. General Motors tanked up 6.5% today, as Johnson was talking about. Ford forged ahead more than 2%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Since 1937, supporting the role that an experienced financial advisor can play in building a well-rounded financial program. Heard a report on Marketplace that you just have to share with your friends, family, or coworkers? Help is just a click away. Our website has each day's complete newscast, individual stories, and transcripts, so you can listen again, print them out, or email them to everyone you know. It's all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Monday. In Washington, the Treasury Department releases the federal budget for January. A Senate committee talks about ways to improve the energy efficiency of buildings. And sex and violence may not be the only factors affecting a parent's decision to keep their kids out of the movie theater. It looks like smoking could join that list. The American Medical Association and others release a national survey they claim shows support for an R rating for movies that show smoking. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Shares of the American power company AES rose today, a bit more than 1.1%. Investors were no doubt relieved about the news out of Caracas, Venezuela. The government of President Hugo Chavez agreed to buy an AES subsidiary for about $800 million. Chavez has promised to nationalize Venezuela's strategic industries, so AES probably knew it wasn't going to get the $2.6 billion for Electricidad de Caracas that it had the company pegged at. We've called Robert Batome in Caracas to talk about that. He edits the economic journal Veneconomia there. Mr. Batome, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What do you suppose it was like in that ceremony yesterday where AES, the American parent company, signed over its interest in what it thinks is a $2.6 billion company for about $800 million?
It's interesting because if you want to argue
well, what's a fair price to pay for the electric company? The price they're paying is very close to the price on the stock market. So therefore you say, well, gee whiz, that's fair enough. And furthermore, they're allowing them to repatriate the proceeds in dollars at the official rate. So what's the argument? Well, the argument gets very complicated. But the gist of it is we've had over 40% inflation in 3 years, and they have not been allowed a rate increase in 3 years. So therefore, the prospects for the company here in Venezuela weren't all that Jim Dandy. And the price of the stock reflected that.
What effect do you think it's going to have on the economy and the infrastructure down there when the state takes control of this company?
We who live in Caracas got a lousy deal because now the state's going to be running the electric company. And anecdotally, I'll tell you that in Caracas is the only city in Venezuela where you don't have candles in the hotel rooms to deal with the frequent blackouts. Everywhere else, since it's the state that runs the electric companies in the interior, everybody else gets accustomed to bad service, blackouts, so on and so forth. And, you know, this plus the purchase of the telephone company, they've taken out 40% of the local stock exchange. So what you're saying is to the little guy, hey, man, don't save because you have no place to go with your money.
What effect do you think this nationalization and nationalizations to come are going to have on foreign investment? It can't
be
a really attractive
investment. Well, first of all, don't call them nationalizations. State takeovers. Nationalization makes it sound a little bit nicer, as if, well, you know, it was being run by those evil foreigners, and now it's ours. It was being run by efficient private sector people, and it's now being taken over by an inefficient state. And it's a disaster for investing here. The only way you can get out is by giving away what you've got here.
What is next to come? We've heard about the phone company. What else is going to be?
Well, there are several small electric companies that will go the same way. The big issue is what are they going to do with the international oil companies who are operating the oil upgraders in the Orinoco heavy oil belt? The president's announced that on May 1, he's going to assume full control of these operations. And it looks like they're not going to go to 100%, but that they're going to go to 60%. But even so, I mean, I'm the foreign investor who's got an agreement that's supposed to run for 40 years, and all of a sudden they're telling me, well, after 10 years, they're telling me, well, we've changed our minds. Why would I want to invest in a country where that happens to people who've been invested before me?
Robert Batome is the editor of Veneconomía. It's an economics journal in Caracas, Venezuela. Mr. Batome, thank you very much for your time.
Okay, I hope I didn't bore you too much.
No, sir, not at all.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. What are you going to do this weekend? A couple of errands, maybe, watch some TV. Pretty standard fare, I'd imagine. The Sabbath for observant Jews, though, is different. Nothing that's considered work in a very broad definition. No writing with indelible ink. No operating electrical switches or machinery. That pretty much puts phones, doorbells, and even coffee makers off limits. But some Israeli rabbis are making machines to keep the faithful inside the letter and the spirit of religious law. From Jerusalem, Shia Levitt reports.
Tal Edensburg has been having a problem with his refrigerator. It's not broken, though. His problem is actually the opposite. He's worried that when he opens or closes the doors on the Sabbath, he might inadvertently set off lights or activate sensors that turn on the cooling system.
The fridge does not have a special device to prevent the motor from working on the Sabbath. So in what way can I open it, and how can I use it on Saturday?
The Institute of Science, Technology, and Religious Law gets more than 100 phone calls and drop-ins each month from people like Edensburg all over the world. Each has a question about how to apply religious law to the modern technology in their lives. At the Institute's Jerusalem office, a team of engineers and rabbis works to design devices that won't break Sabbath laws. In one room, an automatic water heater sits beside the prototype of a mechanical wheelchair. The room is crowded with appliances. It's almost like a mini museum. Rabbi Shmuel Strauss picks up a special Shabbat phone with holes on each button on the dialer. Instead of pressing the button, you put a peg into the hole.
Each number is trying to dial itself at the same time, but something is inhibiting each number from dialing itself. When I put that stick in, I am simply blocking that which is blocking the number from dialing itself.
He says this Shabbat device isn't for everyday use in homes, but for emergency use only. The phone uses a principle called grama, or indirect action. When you turn something on indirectly, there's often a computer processor that checks the position of a peg or switch every few seconds. When it senses that something has changed, it completes the task, dials the number, or turns on the device. So the Shabbat phone user is not technically dialing, not technically doing the work.
Define doing. It's a direct action. Well, what about indirect action? The Torah does not prohibit indirect action.
But isn't that cheating?
Cynical people who come in say, gee, that's great. The Almighty said keep Shabbat, and you guys are finding ways around it.
Strauss says the Torah also commands its followers enjoy the Sabbath. He and his colleagues have spent years studying what they say are the Torah's intentional loopholes, technicalities built into religious law that can help maintain health, security, and quality of life.
What we do here at the Institute is investigate the principles and see what new options are available in terms of coping with exceptional circumstances.
They've even gotten some businesses on board to sell Shabbat products. Israeli company Relco paid the Institute to develop Shabbat-compliant refrigerators. They've now embedded the Shabbat control function into their newer model. At a shopping mall outside Tel Aviv, CEO Yaron Ruziak drops in on a store that sells the product. He says he's having a hard time getting the religious community to take notice.
The Orthodox market is not responding to typical business actions. They don't watch TV. They don't read the newspapers that we read. And they have their own logic, which for the last 20 years I'm trying to figure out. I haven't made that much success yet.
Most of the sales come from non-religious people who just need a fridge. They even got the blessing of Israel's chief rabbi, but it still hasn't helped.
Although we're doing the best to make a perfect solution, it doesn't mean that the customers approve, appreciate, or accept it.
As for the Shabbat phones, Strauss says the Institute sells them directly to the public for $300 each, but they don't advertise. He says people who need the phones eventually find their way to the Institute's door. In Jerusalem, I'm Shaya Levitt for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, lapses in judgment have landed a couple of executives in some hot water. First up is U.S. Airways Chief Doug Parker. Arizona police said today he was arrested last week on a drunk driving charge, just hours after his airline's bid for Delta was rejected. He's scheduled to appear in court in about a week, but other than the embarrassment, there's been no serious repercussion for him yet. Same can't be said for Jim Samples, general manager and executive vice president of the Cartoon Network. Remember that incident in Boston last week, the marketing stunt that created a terrorism scare? Samples said he's resigning today so the network can get back to what it does best. Cartoons, not fake bombs. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Friday afternoon. Today the Dow dropped 56 points, about a half a percent. The NASDAQ lost 28 points, 1.1%. The S&P 500 fell 10 points. That is 0.7%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, a chance to bend it with Beckham.
It's got this sense, I think, of a dream. I mean, here's a guy who you could pluck off the streets of L.A. who's going to wind up playing with David Beckham. Can you imagine?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.